kind of had to give away what I'm doing. The introduction, it won't be all that clever when you already see what's going on behind me anyway. But if I were to say, after leaving the harbor, we met some people for dinner at Sabatino's, and then we made the trip to Highland Town, and the next day we made it to Dundalk, after which we spent the afternoon going all the rest of the way to Fort Howard. I don't think there's anybody in here who have a clue what I was talking about. I don't think so. You wouldn't know what I was talking about. If I gave you some details of conversations I had at Sabatino's and some people we met along the way and told you some events that happened along the way, you would have an understanding of those events. You might have a knowledge of those conversations, and you might be able to draw some conclusions based on that, but you still wouldn't have any idea where I was or what I was doing. Why is that? Well, because those names don't mean anything to you. You may have never been there to any of those places. What you might understand are some events, or you might understand some conversations, but you don't understand the context. The context would be lost on you. You wouldn't understand that I was in downtown Baltimore near the Inner Harbor, and the Inner Harbor is not a place where there are boats that unload cargo like at normal harbors. It's just a shopping place and a touristy place. And then I went to Little Italy, which is just a few blocks away, and had dinner at Sabatino's, an Italian restaurant in Little Italy, along with dozens of other Italian restaurants in Little Italy. And going in that direction toward the east, that I eventually went to a place that evening. I made it that evening. I was walking, and I could make it all the way to Highland, or make it all the way to Highlandtown. It's a long walk, but you wouldn't know that Highlandtown was a Polish community that's been that way for many years. And you wouldn't know that I had to walk through some very bad sections of town to get from Little Italy to Highlandtown. You also wouldn't know that that the next day I made it to Dundalk during the day, maybe by about lunchtime. And Dundalk is where the real port is, the marine terminal and so forth, where the real trade goes on. And Dundalk's a working class neighborhood community, but it's not as, people aren't as well off as it used to be because there's less jobs at the port, and there's the steel mills have closed down, and the shipyards have closed down, and the GM manufacturing plant closed down. These different things have closed down. And so the people in that community aren't as well off as they used to be, and it's not as nice of a community as it once was. And then finally I made it all the way to Fort Howard. Now, when I get to Fort Howard, that's a place that's out on the Chesapeake Bay. And I'm at the water again. I've left the Baltimore Harbor, I've gone, and I'm out at the Chesapeake Bay. And I happen to be in a community that is the community where my mother spent her early childhood, and coincidentally, my father-in-law lived just a few blocks away. They didn't know each other. We found out later they grew up in the same community. You wouldn't know all that. You wouldn't know a thing. You wouldn't know that, you know, when it got to Fort Howard, you know, my mom actually had their house was on the water. You wouldn't understand all that. You might get some of the story. You might get much of the story. You might even understand the points, the events that happened. But you wouldn't have the whole story because you're missing the context. You're missing the where. You're missing the who. You're missing the why. You might have the what. You might have the when. But you're missing a lot of other details. And, of course, you know, what's my point? My point is that it's no different when you read the Bible. We read stories of people who interact. We learn about life from understanding those interactions, people that have conversations, people that have events where they're dealing with one another. And we can learn a lot from that. But are we understanding all that we can? I submit that we don't understand all that we can. And I don't mean just because God isn't revealing to us all that he has for us. I understand that. And that's not my point today. My point is that there's a lot more we can understand if we go to the trouble to find out. Because we can find out who are those people? And where are those people? And why are they there? What kind of people are they? And the answers to these questions can fill out the stories for us. Because they're the context. They're the context of what the people in the Bible were doing. The information fills in the blanks. It makes the stories complete. So the events of the Bible happened long ago and far away. The more we understand about long ago and far away, the more meaningful the biblical events can be for us, I think. We've been reading from the Gospel of Matthew. Mike read from Matthew chapter 14 today. And what I'd like to do today is spend some time today exploring the context of what we've been reading in the first 14 chapters of Matthew. Jesus' early ministry is covered in these chapters and some more chapters to come. You know, where was Jesus What was he doing there? What kind of people were there? Who were these people? What was it like to be there, live there, walk there? Now, I've never been there. I've never walked there. I should have my brother come and give this talk. But the point, I can do some research, and I'm going to share that research with you. And at least we'll open the door a little bit to understanding a little bit more about the context. Because when Matthew and Mark and Luke and John wrote their Gospels, especially the first three, I suspect, I mean, I can't get into their sandals and figure out exactly what they were thinking, but I suspect that they assumed that their audience would understand some things that you and I don't understand almost 2,000 years later. Because we're so far removed from that time in history and from that place over in the Middle East that what they wrote doesn't have the same meaning for us as it did for those who read it right then and there and in the hundreds of years afterwards. Because we're removed from that context. So maybe, just maybe, we're missing something. And I suggest we are. So today, let's look at, and if you like titles, Galilee, the context of Jesus' ministry, and specifically his early ministry, because he did move on later on down to Judea. But he's in Galilee to begin his ministry. First thing I want to do is talk about the map. I've got a map up here. Got to talk loud because I'm moving away from the microphone, sorry. But I got a pointer. This map is not drawn to scale, and it's not even a good map. And to you, it probably just looks like a whole bunch of lines there. One of the big problems when I drew this is that the board is horizontal in the room. If it went vertically, I could do better. It's a little bit fatter than it should be from side to side, not quite as tall as it should be. So it's out of scale that way. But we get an idea. You have maps in your, if you have a map in your Bible, turn to that, because it'll be better than this map, but I'll have something to point to. I can't point to the map in your Bible. But if you've got a map that shows Palestine, as they call it, or in the time of Jesus, you can turn there and you can see some of these same things. We have talked in the past, by the way, of a lot of the history that leads up to Jesus' ministry. You remember Dr. John spoke about the Herods, and we'll talk about the Herods just a little bit today. I've given at least one, maybe two sermons about a lot of the history that led up to the Herods and their time and how we got to that point. And now we're going to be in the period of time when Jesus is walking the earth, John the Baptist walking the earth, and all of those things we talked about before have come together to result in a type of civilization that made it possible for the early church to start. And that wasn't by coincidence. God made sure that it would happen that way. We've talked about that. So if you've got a map, like I say, it'll be better than this one. Because Israel as a country now and then was longer. This almost looks kind of square here. It's not. It's longer this way than it is this way. But what you have in the north is you have the Sea of Galilee. Okay? And in the south you have the Dead Sea. Both of these bodies of water are what? Who knows? Lower than sea level. This is over 1,000 feet below sea level, I believe. The Sea of Galilee is 690 feet below sea level. But the Sea of Galilee is fresh water. It's being fed by the Jordan, and it's plenty fresh. And actually a couple other little rivers are coming this way. And then it empties out. By the time it gets to the Dead Sea is literally dead. It's much deader than the salt sea we have in this country, from what I understand. This is the Mediterranean over here. Okay, you've got the ocean over here, and then going this way, you get into other kingdoms, in particular Parthia. The Parthians were enemies of Rome. Rome never did conquer and get rid of the Parthian problem. There was always an issue with what Parthia was going to do, and it actually affects the world that Jesus walked in, some of the tension between Parthia and Rome. But that's over this way. Up here, you've got Syria. The city of Damascus, of course, which is still there. You've got Syria to the north. What we call this area here today, we call it the Golan Heights. You know, they got Israel has control of that. There's heights all around. Why? Because the Sea of Galilee, which is basically just a lake, I got dimensions over here. It's about 12 miles this way, about 8 miles across. So it's not very big. You can see from one side to the other. And all around it, because it's down lower than sea level. All around it are you call them mountains. I mean, they're not that big. It's highlands all around. When you get to the north, when you get to the north of the Sea of Galilee, you've got some very rich farmland. I think in the Old Testament, they call it Bashan, the cattle of Bashan. And I may turn to it later, but there are scriptures referring to, I remember when Solomon talked to the king of Tyre about getting certain supplies from him. Hiram wanted stuff from Israel in return, and what did he want? He wanted food. He wanted food, and this is where it came from. This is the bread, kind of a bread basket up there. You've got a highlands in the middle. You've got the Dead Sea over here. You've got ridges right next to the Jordan, and in between, you've got highlands before you come down to the coastal plain again. So from the coast, it's flat. It goes up. And Jerusalem's up. In the Bible, you always hear about they're going up to Jerusalem. Does that mean, is that just a metaphor? No. They went uphill. You have to go uphill to get to Jerusalem from most anywhere. And you have mountains along this side of the Dead Sea. You also have some mountains here. Mount Carmel's right here out here. These are rather tall. The highest mountains in Israel are up here north. I don't even have enough room to put that in. The board didn't go high enough. But that would be Mount Hermon. And Mount Hermon's high by our standards. It's, I think, 9,200 feet. 9,200 feet. That's a pretty high mountain. We don't have anything on the East Coast like that. You got to go out west in the United States to get a mountain like that. And that's up here. Now, we talked before, and we need to talk again, I think, just to remind you. This is a strategic piece of real estate. Why? Remember? What do you got down here? Egypt, a power for thousands of years. What do you have up here? Syria, a power for not thousands of years, maybe 1,000 years at this time. What do you have over here around the Mediterranean? Rome, Italy, the current power. You got Parthia over here, or Iran, Iraq, the ancient kingdoms of Babylonia, Persia, are over here. Anytime you had interaction between these peoples, right? Egypt wants to attack Syria. Where do they have to go? They got to go marching, through these roads. In red, I have the roads. These are major trade routes that came through. There was an international highway. There was a king's highway. So the trade that came down from Damascus in the north went around the Sea of Galilee, and then got on one road or another to get down to Jerusalem and then on further to Egypt. Actually, to go to Egypt, you didn't have to go through Jerusalem. You could stay to the west a little bit. So you had all these major roads coming through this area. What were roads good for? Trade. What else used roads? Travel for people. In that society, what was very important about the roads? Who needs to use roads? Armies. Armies use roads. So these roads were very important to Rome to maintain control. So if Egypt wanted to come up here back, and we talked about this in past history, Egypt wasn't a problem at this time. But in the past, if Egypt wanted to come up this way, it'd come up through this area. If Syria wanted to go to Egypt, it'd get the same thing. If any of the other Babylonia Empire, the Persian Empire, these people wanted to have dealings with Egypt, you had to go through this area. It was right in the middle. And I heard an interesting message from somebody, Doug Greenwald to be exact, and he said, everything about Jesus' ministry was strategically planned. And I hadn't thought about it this way before. He said that God could have planned to have emissaries, missionaries, whatever, from Jesus just go all over the world. And eventually that happened, of course. But much simpler, when you think about it, to put Jesus right here, and the world comes to him. So he preached for 3.5 years, and all these armies, the legions that were stationed there, the legions that moved back and forth, all the trade, they came by and they heard about him. So his fame spread abroad without him having to go anywhere. So that was strategic. You've got Jerusalem down here. All right, this is Galilee up here. This is Nazareth, approximately a little bit south. Actually, a little further south than that. So you're going down toward Jerusalem, but that's and Bethlehem is near Jerusalem. Bethlehem would be where Joseph's people came from. Cana, I've got marked. I've got Capernaum, some other cities up by the Sea of Galilee. One other thing I want to point out, and this is significant. In black, I've got these lines. I could have put a black line right here, too, but Jordan River's a barrier. These are the regions the way Rome looked at them. These are the regions where the way Rome looked at them. Remember when Dr. Johns talked about Herod the Great? Herod the Great was this semi-Jewish king from Idumea that ended up ruling the whole area here up till 4 BC, about the time that Jesus was born. He died. In his will, which Rome felt bound to honor, he split up his kingdom into three territories to be ruled by three of his sons. One of those areas is commonly called Judea. It included Samaria and Idumea. Judea, which is where Jerusalem was. Another area was Galilee. That was another region. Up here, I don't know how to say these, Trachonitis and maybe Iturea. They were ruled by one of Herod's sons. Perea was ruled by the same person that ruled this side. The Decapolis, meaning 10 cities, were free cities. They weren't ruled by any of the Herods. It was in Rome's interest to let these people have a certain amount of self-governance and be happy. Why? Because what was on this side? Parthia. So let these people be happy and allied with Rome. They're free cities. I imagine that means they didn't have to pay any tribute. You know, just keep them happy. Keep the Parthians that much further away. So that's a free city, or a free area. The Decapolis was mostly either Hellenized Jews, that is, very worldly Jews, you could say, or heathens, just out-and-out heathens, Gentiles. That will come into play later on. In Galilee, where Jesus' early ministry was, you had Hellenized Jews. You also had very devout Jews. The Pharisees, they were up there. So you had those kind of people. And in Judea, you had a mixture. You had the Samaritans, which the Jews didn't want to have anything to do with. And down in Idumea, it doesn't really play into it, but you had those people that weren't considered real Jews either. And then, of course, around in and around Jerusalem, you had all the, you had lots of legalistic type Jews, but you had lots of also some some worldly Jews. It's important to understand too, when you want to get the context here. You know, we live in the 21st century, and we hear on the news all the time that you got these countries in other parts of the world that want to impose Sharia law on their citizens. You've heard that term, Sharia law? You know what that is? Anybody know? What is that? Sharia law. What is that? It's law. It's ruled by the Quran, by the precepts of the Quran. Islamic religious law being the law of the land. And we go, oh, that's terrible. It doesn't have anything to do with freedom. But you know what? If you were a Jew living at the time of Christ, especially if you were in Judea or you were a pious Jew living in Galilee, what did you want? You wanted the Torah to be the law of the land. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. That's what you wanted. Rome, in order to have a certain amount of peace, kind of cooperate, there was a cooperative effort, you know, they all scratched each other's back, and the Torah was the law of the land to a certain extent. But you had we talked about them before, the different groups, one of them called the Zealots, who were always chomping at the bit for a revolution. They were like modern-day Islamists in that they wanted to overthrow the existing governments, if you want to put it that way, and institute rule of the Torah under their terms. And you had others like the community of Qumran that just, the Essenes, had just dropped out of society altogether. Didn't even, they kind of were a bit hermit, like hermits, and had their own communities because they didn't want to submit to the government. So you had people that wanted this total rule by the Torah, which we wouldn't have an argument with, but you can imagine if you were Roman, you might have a problem with it. So this is what you've got going on. You've got these political divisions ruled kind of by descendants of Herod, or his sons. He had another son. This gets confusing, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I want to mention it because it confused me, and I was sitting there trying to figure it out and read a little bit. This was Herod Antipas here, okay? Then you had Herod Archelaus down here, and you had Herod Philip up here. And this guy up here, in fact, you've heard of Caesarea Philippi. That's a way of naming a city after Caesar and yourself at the same time up here. This, again, is free. Herod the Great was not loved. He was cruel, but he was clever. And he was able to rule, build great cities and all that stuff. His son here in Galilee was doing the same thing, could build great things. His son that ruled Judea didn't last too long, from 4 BC to about 6 AD, maybe about, 9 years? Didn't last too long. Because, why? Because he was just as ruthless and cruel as his father, but he wasn't as clever. And the people got so fed up with him, they petitioned Rome, and Rome got rid of him. Kind of, I think he's still there, but he didn't really have any power. And who had the power? People like Pilate, career bureaucrats. They were like the Rome State Department. These weren't ruthless rulers in general. They were, a lot of them were just career bureaucrats in the Roman government, and are sent out to try to maintain the peace in different areas. And Pilate was one of the ones sent to Judea to rule Judea. Okay, so maybe enough of that background. Oh, what I wanted to mention, this gets confusing. This Herod's name was Philip, but Herod had another son named Philip who lived where? In Rome, and didn't get any of the... He had sons, and these sons weren't all full brothers with each other. Okay, this Herod and this Herod were full brothers. This Herod was a half-brother. Let me get it straight here. This Herod fell in love with his half-brother's wife over in Rome. John the Baptist said, you can't have your half-brother's wife. And there was he was even related to the woman a little bit, somehow or another. John the Baptist said no, and that's what got him in prison. And as we read today, he eventually got him killed because he took a stand against this Herod having his half-brother, Philip, not this one Philip, but the Philip that's over in Rome. That's what gets so confusing. They name people the same name. And they want the same woman, and I don't know. But as Dr. John said in his sermon, that the Herod bunch were a bunch, to put it that way. So by the time Jesus' ministry, starting his ministry, the Herod that was down here, Archelaus, he had no power, and he wasn't ruling. It was ruled by the Roman government, and eventually it was Pilate. Now, let's get specific now. I've given you a big picture. Let's get a smaller picture around Galilee. Galilee, the lake here, about 8 miles across, 12 miles, fresh water. A lot of fishing, a lot of other industry around the lake. You've got these major trade routes, not just like a little road, but major international trade routes coming right around this lake. So if you lived somewhere on this lake, what would you try to do? Sell fish or make something else and sell it? I mean, you're right next to the highway. It's just like, somebody lives near a big city in a lot of parts of the world. You figure out something that you can sell. So you had a lot of industry around the lake here, and they used the lake to get the goods up to Capernaum, which was the main city and the hub of commerce. So there was a lot of sea traffic on the Sea of Galilee, which sometimes could be tricky, because remember what I told you, it's 690 feet below sea level. You got mountains up around it. So you get these weird wind patterns. And if I can, I'll read you a quote here. I'm not ready to read it, I don't think. I don't know where I've got it. But these winds would just come up all of a sudden. And we just found out about that. It's not a big lake, so everything looks calm, and you're ready to sail across, looks fine, and you get halfway across, all of a sudden, you get these terrible winds. And that wasn't uncommon. That's just something that happened because of the way it sat down in a bowl and the way the winds would act. So there's a lot of commerce on this lake. But if you weren't sailing from one part of the lake to the other, you were walking. That's what people did. So again, if you want to get into the context of what's going on in Jesus' ministry, he's walking. Capernaum to Cana is about 7 hours, according to one resource. from Cana to Nazareth is about 5 hours. It doesn't look that far on a map. I guess, you know, there weren't good roads. Whatever. You had to walk on the roads. If you wanted to travel from Capernaum down to Jerusalem, you had a choice. You could go this way, come down through the Jordan Valley and back up. It took about 8 days. What's the problem with 8 days? Sabbath. Can't travel on the Sabbath. Really, it takes 7 days, but it takes eight and a half because you can't travel. And then you need a place to stay and you get all this complication. So, because of that aggravation, I mean, some would do it. Others would travel this way and come down to Jerusalem, which only took about 5 days. What's the problem with going this way? Well, there were good roads through there, so you didn't have to go over any steep mountains. What's the problem with this way? Samaria. The Jews didn't want to have anything to do with Samaritans. So, you know, it's a trade-off. You had to travel through the Sabbath or you had to travel through Samaria. It was a lose-lose situation, but you had to do it one way or the other. Because why? Because they had to go to Jerusalem for the holy days. Three pilgrimage feasts, right? Had to go up to Jerusalem. Let me read, I guess that's from this. This is the pictorial, the Zondervan Pictorial Bible Atlas. I'm going to read from page 301 as soon as I find it. I want to mention about the breadbasket area up here in the Golan Heights, the Bashan, as it's known in the Old Testament. Well, I guess I want page 300. Of all the regions into which it was then divided, talking about this area of the world, the most fertile was the Galilean territory of Herod Antipas' tetrarchy. It provided food not only for its own inhabitants, but for the neighbors as well. When, for example, Luke mentions in Acts 12:20 that the Tyrrhenians and Sidonians depended on the king's country for food, the king here being Antipas' nephew and brother-in-law, Herod Agrippa, who's the first, who died in AD 44, it is Galilee that he had in mind. The situation described was exactly that nearly a millennium early, 1,000 years before, when King Hiram of Tyre said to Solomon, "You shall meet my wishes by providing food for my household." And Solomon responded by supplying him with 120,000 bushels of wheat and nearly 1 million gallons of olive oil. That's from 1 Kings 5, verses 9 to 11. So this area was known for being agriculturally very rich. In fact, the whole area up here was known as being rich. Why? Because of all the trade. You know, if you weren't selling your olive oil or selling your wheat, you were making a trinket and selling it or whatever. You were involved in trading. Somehow or another, you were making money. The towns were thriving there. There's a quote I wanted. I didn't write it down. Let me see if I can find it very quickly here. Probably can't. If not, I'll paraphrase it for you. No, I'm not going to find it. The expression that some of the rabbis in Judea would say, if you want something to the effect, if you want to be holy, live in Jerusalem. If you want to be rich, live in Galilee. In other words, the people, the Jews, the pious Jews in Jerusalem, looked down on the Galileans, even Jews. Why? Because they were up there to get rich. And they talked funny. They had an accent. Remember Peter? around the fire there, and the one woman said, "Aren't you one of them? I recognize you. Your accent gives you away," and he denied. So the down here, which is where Peter was at the time, they recognized who was from up here because of the way they talked. Maybe other mannerisms as well. Oh, I do have it here, page 99. So that's the map. Now I want to talk just a little bit about the culture. Just not a lot. And I've got quotes here I want to read from these books. This book is called Exploring Bible Times. It's by Dr. James Martin. It's a book that tries to explore just what I'm doing today, explore the context of the Gospels in particular. Although it actually starts in the Old Testament, but at least half the book's about the Gospels. On page 99. There were a variety of cultures that existed around the Sea of Galilee during the New Testament. Period. The northwestern region of the sea contained an observant Jewish population. Northwestern, right here, this area. An observant Jewish population, people that were pious, that obeyed the Torah scrupulously, led by the Pharisees as their interpreters of the law. Hellenized Jews dominated the western and northeastern section. Well, northeastern here, on this side of Jordan, they were Hellenized, and also over here, further down the coast. Excuse me. While Gentiles governed the southeastern region, which is Decapolis, the free area. These were Gentiles. The gathering area where the demon-possessed people were that Jesus went to. We'll talk about that later. To say the least, not all the inhabitants around the lake saw eye to eye. The plurality of cultures around the Sea of Galilee can be well demonstrated by various events recorded in the Gospels. The following information reveals the extent and such cultural diversity surrounding Jesus and his disciples within the context of the first century A.D. I'll read a little bit here. Historical sources mention continual presence of military forces from the surrounding nations exerting themselves on the region of Galilee. Why? Because it's a major trade hub. You've got all these people coming through. The Romans needed to control that. This is from Josephus in Wars of the Jews. These two Galilees, that is upper and lower, of such great largeness and encompassed with so many nations of foreigners, have always been able to make a strong resistance on all occasions of war. There was an undercurrent of rebellion here, usually, in Galilee, because you had all these different kind of people, and you're not going to satisfy them all anytime. For this reason, leaving Josephus back to the book here. For this reason, the area was called in Hebrew Hagilah Hagoyim, translated the Galilee of the Nations. Lots of different people there. The Hebrew name Galil is translated, literated into the Greek Galileia, means circle, signifying a district or region. That's where you get Galilee. I can't pronounce these, the way you would in Hebrew, but you transliterate that word into Greek, and it sounds like Galilee. And of course, the Hebrew word goyim is translated in the Bible many times Gentiles or nations. This area, by the way, is up in the north. If you're looking in your Bible atlases or in your Bibles there, what are the tribes that are up here? Anybody see the tribes that are up here in the north around the Sea of Galilee? Anybody have one of those maps open? No? Dan's further north. I think it's Naphtali and Zebulun. In Isaiah chapter 9, verse 1, I'm going to read Isaiah chapter 9, verses 1 and 2. Notice something here. This is interesting to me. Nevertheless, Isaiah 9, 1. I'm in the King James here. The dimness shall not be such as was in her vexation, when at first he lightly afflicted the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, and afterwards did more grievously afflict her by the way of the seal beyond Jordan in Galilee of the nations. Galilee of the nations, there's that phrase. The people that walked in darkness have seen a great light. From Messiah, remember that? I won't sing it. The people that walk in darkness have seen a great light. They that dwell in the land of the shadow of death, upon them has the light shined. What is that light referring to? It's the Messiah. That's where the Messiah's ministry started, up in Galilee. Skipping to the next page here. Most people who lived in the Galilee region did so because of potential wealth. The rich, fertile soil allowed for prosperous agriculture. The trade along major commercial routes held great potential for economic gain. Since economic wealth and agricultural productivity were more accessible in the Galilee, while Judea provided access to many of the sages, the wise rulers of the Jews, it became a common Jewish statement that if a person wishes to be rich, let him go north. If he wants to be wise, let him come south. Okay, that's what I was referring to. As a result, the large majority of the Jewish population in Galilee assimilated into the Greco-Roman lifestyle that dominated the region. That is, they became Hellenized. That's another way to say it. The rabbis therefore suggested that Galilee was to Judaism the court of the Gentiles, the rabbinic schools of Judea, its innermost sanctuary. So it's almost like throwing, you know, kind of like Christians sometimes do today, you know, comparing between the different shades and saying you're almost like you're outside the temple. As it turned out, rabbinic circles in Judea held a general contempt for Galileans, not only for their tendencies toward assimilation, but their awkward pronunciation of the Hebrew language. And they give a story about that. There had always been a sense of a latent rebellion. And it wasn't just in Galilee, it was also in Judea, but more so in Galilee. And I'm going to read another quote here. In other words, the Romans had to always be careful because the situation was never very far from boiling over to where you'd have a revolution on your hands. That's just the way it was when you tried to govern the Jews back then in that part of the world. From page 101 of the same book, Exploring Bible Times, there were, however, pockets of Jewish nationalism to be found in Galilee. They weren't all Hellenized, in other words. They weren't all going along with the program and getting rich. Okay. After Mattathias Antigonus had run Herod the Great out of the country back in 40 BC, Antigonus proceeded to fortify strongholds in Galilee. When Herod the Great returned to reestablish Roman control, Herod went to Rome and said, hey, this is going on. And Rome backed him up, sent some money so he could buy some mercenaries, and they pushed this other guy out. So he was able to reestablish control over Galilee. He had this, Herod the Great had to face opposition from observant Jews, those that wanted to keep faithful to the Mosaic law, who had settled in the region of Galilee. Now this is from Josephus again. Herod marched to take the remaining parts of Galilee to drive away the garrisons placed there by Antigonus. But when Herod had reached the Sepphoris in very great snow, he took the city without any difficulty. After which he hasted away to the robbers, that might be a bad translation, it's people who lived in these cliffs, that were in the caves, who overran a great part of the country and did a great mischief to the inhabitants as a war itself could have done. There were these people who resisted the government and went off and lived in the caves. Sound familiar? We got them in this country. And they weren't conquerable. There are some stories here about how some of them were conquered, but a lot of them killed their families rather than give themselves up to the government. The struggle for Jewish independence was also present during the time Jesus began his ministry around the sea. Not everyone in Galilee wanted to assimilate. Those Jews who longed for their nation to be free from Roman occupation insulated themselves from the Roman culture around them and set their minds and hearts to look for the kingdom of God. Now, stopping the quote here, that's not a bad motivation, is it? You know, I talked about this before. The Pharisees come in for a lot of condemnation from Jesus, right? But, you know, because they missed the point and because they were hard on people and so forth. But their motivation, at least some of their motivation, was to try to do what was right, to try to follow the law. They just added to the law, which God warned against. But, you know, to say you want to follow the law and you want to resist foreign occupation, that is their mentality, the paganism, that's a good thing. So, you know, they weren't totally bad, put it that way. But listen to these laws. Because you wanted to resist. Now, this is, I think this is Peter. He's talking about in Acts 10. You know, you yourselves know how unlawful it is for a man who is a Jew to associate with a foreigner or to visit him. But yet God was showing Peter he had to do that. But the Jews knew they couldn't associate with the foreigners. That was the Jew. That wasn't God's law. That was their law. To try to keep from being, I guess you could compare it maybe a little bit to the Amish. Or some of the plain people in this part of the world here. Where you don't want to mix too much with the other people because their ways of life will rub off on you. And God had warned the Israelites in the Old Testament, same thing. Don't marry their women because you'll start being like them. You'll start becoming pagan. So part of the rationale was sensible. Here's another rule. This is from the Mishnah. Listen to this. The daughter of an Israelite may not assist a Gentile woman in childbirth since she would be assisting to bring to birth a child for idolatry. You know? Now, how does that sound? Sounds to me, personally, it sounds a little twisted. It's taking maybe a good motivation and turning it around to something negative. But that's the way they thought. And it's important to realize that. When we get to Matthew, I'm not going to go through everything that happened in Matthew, but I want to bring out a few points that where the cultural things that we're talking about have an impact on what happened. Such anti-Roman sentiments, back to the book here, not to mention the Jewish expectations of a military Messiah, were considered treasonous from Rome's perspective, and you can understand that. Yet, with Jewish nationalism high in Israel during the first century, some presented themselves as the Messiah, attempting to break from Rome's occupation. And you've heard of these people. Here's something else from Josephus. Menahem, the son of Judas, that was called the Galilean, Judas the Galilean, who was a very cunning sophister, had formally reproached the Jews under Cyrenius, and that after God they were subject to the Romans, in parentheses. This man took some men of note with him and retired to Masada, where he broke open the King Herod's armory, gave arms not only to his own people, to other robbers also. He made use these he made use of for a guard and returned in the state of a king to Jerusalem. He became leader of the sedition, gave orders for continuing the siege. So it sounds like the militia people that we have out, you know, in some parts of our country now in the United States. They had those kinds of people there. And they had Scripture, quote-unquote, on their side, because Scripture prophesied a Messiah that was going to lead Israel. They didn't understand how Messiah was going to lead Israel, but they knew the Messiah was promised. So they're looking for one. And there was this Judas of Galilee. And then there's this Yeshua of Galilee who performs miracles. Were people looking for him? Yes, they were. Yes, they were. Why were there so many people following him around? Why were these crowds? Well, because he fed them and he healed them. You know, he gave them things. But they were looking for somebody like him to lead them out of the occupation, the Roman occupation. And these were the observant Jews. Okay. I can get going. Sorry. Let's go to the story. It's Matthew chapter 2. I'll skip chapter 1 with the genealogies. With this in mind, these things, and there's a lot more, let's get to the story and see how some of this impacts what we read, what we have read over the past few months. Matthew chapter 2, verse 1, I'm in the King James. I'll just basically stick with Matthew, although we can, with Matthew's chronology of events anyway, since that's what we've been reading. Notice chapter 2, verse 1. When Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, well, that's not just an expression, it's where Bethlehem was. It was in Judea. It was in that Roman province, or procurate, I guess it was called. In Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, there came wise men, the King James has it, from the east to Jerusalem. Now, who were these people? Well, I won't get into that too much. But he said, "Where is he that's born King of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east, and we're come to worship him." When Herod the king had heard these things, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Remember, Herod had been thrown out by this Antigonus. Herod went. I mentioned briefly that Herod went to Rome, got money for a mercenary army, came back, kicked this guy out, reestablished his control over Galilee and the rest of Judea. This whole area. And he was declared to be, I didn't mention this, king of the Jews by the Romans. So, Herod is king of the Jews, right? These guys come from the east. What's east? Parthia. I can't prove it. I think they were Jews, Israelites, one or the other, both. They're people that knew that the Messiah was being born. And so I think they were Jews or Israelites. Jews or other Israelites. One or the other. It's my personal opinion. From the east, from area out there, toward Parthia, if not in Parthia. From Exploring Bible Times, I'm going to go to page 72. Herod would have been greatly threatened with the arrival of the Parthian Jews. He just flat out says it is. That's this guy's opinion too. Parthian Jews from the east, since it was a group of Jewish nationalists along with the Parthian army from Persia that was responsible for running Herod out of Jerusalem some 35 years earlier. That was Antigonus that I just told you about. Skipping on down. Herod the Great had been proclaimed king of the Jews by the Roman government. If the wise men were Parthian Jews, their request to see the true Jewish king would have been a major insult to Herod. Can you imagine that? You show up, knock on, you know, to the king of the Jews, asking to see the king of the Jews that was just born. You know, and you're looking past him. And to the Herods, these guys were not, you know, meek mild. You know, they were ornery. And you know, why didn't Herod just bump them off? Well, why? Because the Parthians were a powerful empire, and Herod couldn't afford to cause any trouble for the Romans. He was in a very precarious situation. Herod could not tolerate such a political threat, for any king of the Parthians was an enemy to Rome. Potential military ramifications with the Parthian Empire may have resulted had Herod taken action against the Magi. So, playing his hand cautiously, Herod extracted all necessary information from the Magi and sent them on their way. The Magi then proceeded to Bethlehem, where they met the young Messiah and presented him with gifts. So that's this James Martin's idea of how it went. I agree. I think that's very reasonable that these men from the east were from Parthia or that area, and that Herod had no use for them at all, but couldn't afford to start anything. Excuse me. Skip down to, you know what Herod did. He ended up trying to figure out the timing and all that type of thing and ended up killing the children in Bethlehem, which was a horrible thing. And, of course, Herod told him, like, once you find him, come back and tell me about him. You know, I want to know. And God warned them in a dream not to do that. And he didn't come back. They didn't come back. Notice verse 13. When they were departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, "Arise, take the young child and his mother, and flee to Egypt, and be thou there till I bring you word that Herod will not seek the young child to destroy him." So where did they go? They had to leave Bethlehem. They had to go southwest to Egypt for their own protection, because Herod was a maniac. Verse 16. Herod, when he saw that he was mocked of the wise men, was very mad. He sent forth and slew all the children that were in Bethlehem and all the coasts thereof from 2 years old and under. So that's how nice a guy he was. It's just horrible. Verse 19. But when Herod was dead, he didn't live much longer than this, the angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, "Arise, take the young child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for they are dead which sought the young child's life." And he rose and took the young child and his mother and came to the land of Israel. But, verse 22, when he heard that Archelaus did reign in Judea in the room of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Remember what I told you about the son that ruled this area? He was just as bad as his dad, only not as smart. When Joseph heard it was him, he knew enough to say, this isn't going to work. Or at least he didn't prefer for it to work, so he moved up to Nazareth. And, of course, the Bible, the Old Testament, had prophesied that Jesus would be a Nazarene, not a Nazarite, which is the one who took the vow, didn't drink alcohol and let the hair grow, but a Nazarene, somebody from Nazareth. I don't think the Bible says who had the connection to Nazareth. I'm not sure. Maybe Mary did or something. I don't know. Might have been some family up there. So they got back to Judea first, were afraid to stay, and kept on moving and went up to Nazareth, which is in the region of Galilee, ruled by another one of Herod's sons. Chapter 3. John the Baptist says, John the Baptist came preaching in the wilderness of Judea. The Bible doesn't specifically say exactly where John preached. You read the resources, and there's belief that it was over here, maybe on this around Jordan, and maybe this area of Perea. It's not clear. It was definitely near the Jordan. Although some people say, well, you know, he said he went to a certain area. He went there because there was much water. And if he was in the Jordan Valley, why would he have to go anywhere? Because there's much, of course, there's much water in the Jordan Valley. Maybe it was somewhere else. I don't know. But he wasn't preaching in and around Jerusalem. He was in the wilderness. He was off north of the Dead Sea, up around the Jordan River. He wasn't up here. At least that's not the main focus of his ministry. Verse 13. Then comes Jesus from Galilee to Jordan unto John to be baptized of him. So Jesus had to come from here, from Galilee, to where John was. Jesus wasn't where John was. Now, you also have to understand, this isn't a very big country, big area. So whatever was happening down here was going to be noised abroad. You were going to hear about it up here and vice versa, especially with all the trade routes, okay, and the Jewish culture that was in both regions. So things didn't just stay in one region. You heard, you know, the people in Galilee knew about John the Baptist, and you know, it wasn't secret when and Jesus went down to be baptized. Chapter 4, that's, of course, the temptation, as it's called, of Jesus, and he was taken to a wilderness. It doesn't explain where that is. We don't know. But there's one thing that's interesting, perhaps, to think about, just for the fun of it. He was led to the wilderness to be tempted of the devil, King James says. In verse 8, again, the devil takes him up to an exceeding high mountain and shows him all the kingdom of the world and the glory of them. Well, the exceeding high mountain was Mount Hermon. It was up here, 9,200 feet. Do we know that that's where he went? No, we don't, but that was the exceeding high mountain. There wasn't anything else like that in the area, at least that particular range that was right there. But we don't know. The wilderness is not identified. But then notice something in verse 13. Verse 12 says, Jesus heard that John was cast into prison. Remember, John told one Herod he couldn't have his Roman brother's wife as his wife, and that got him in prison. And I think the scripture says somewhere else that it would have killed him, but he was afraid because people thought John was a prophet, so he just stuck him in prison. He just wanted to get rid of him one way or the other. He would have killed him if he could. And then he only did kill him when he got tricked into it, as Mike read about today. Verse 12 says that John was put into prison. Then Jesus knew it was his time. And verse 13, and leaving Nazareth, he came and dwelt in Capernaum, which is upon the seacoast in the borders of Zebulun and Naphtali. So what's that telling us? Telling us that he had grown up and had his family business or whatever else in Nazareth. Now it's time for his ministry. And everything, as Doug Greenwald says, everything in Jesus' ministry was strategically planned. This wasn't the crossroads. This was the crossroads, Capernaum. And that's where Jesus went to start his ministry. Northwest shore of the Sea of Galilee in Capernaum, the main city there. He took up residence in Capernaum. And that's where he was going to start his ministry and call his disciples and so forth. Let's read verse 15. Sorry. Well, we already read. This is where it quotes the prophecy from Isaiah, saying that this fulfilled prophecy. Jesus' ministry had to happen here because it was already prophesied. Now, Capernaum, interesting. It's the word, you can read it in your Bible, Capernaum. It's from two Hebrew words, and I don't know how to pronounce them right, but one of them is Kephar, K-E-F-A-R in English. Kephar Nahum, meaning the village of Nahum. That's what Capernaum is the village of Nahum. I think I mentioned this already, there were Roman troops garrisoned there to keep control. Very important crossroads, international crossroads, and there were Roman troops there to make sure everything was on the up and up. Jesus, it says in verse 18, walking by the Sea of Galilee, saw two brothers, Simon, called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And that's one of the occupations of many people around the Sea of Galilee. There were lots of fish in the Sea of Galilee, including one of them that has a Latin name, tilapia. Now we use that all the time. It's one of the farmed fishes we use today. So you had a lot of fishing going on around here. And Jesus was, the Capernaum was right on the shore there. So he calls Simon and Andrew, and he tells them he's going to make them fishers of men. And they left their nets and followed him. And then going from there, he saw two brothers, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother. And they were with their father mending nets, and they left. And I've read this before, and I'm thinking, Yeah, they just left the dad. You know, they had all these nets. And these weren't little nets. The ones that they had in the boats out in the sea, they could be 100 yards long. The regular drag nets, or I think called drag nets, the big long ones. They could be huge. And so they're helping dad there, and they're just leaving with the nets. Well, I think it's good to look at Mark chapter 1 and verse 20. I'll just read it. It wasn't exactly that way. Mark 1 verse 20 says, "And straightway he called them," talking about James and John, the sons of Zebedee, "and they left their father Zebedee in the ship with the hired servants." So they didn't leave him alone trying to repair the net by himself. They had, you know, the big fishing operations had hired hands to help, because these are huge nets. And just read you something again from Exploring Bible Times, which I think is very interesting about fishermen. This book says, and I don't have any reason to doubt it, methods of fishing remained the same from New Testament times until 1948. At this time, the Arab fishermen who had preserved the ancient customs left the area. So as you know, you may have read about other things, certain things really didn't change too much over the years until the last century. And so we can look back just in the 20th century and see probably some of the systems that were in place when James and John and Andrew and Peter were doing their fishing. This is tell you how it all worked in terms of who got paid how much. The income from a catch was divided according to the ancient fishing tradition of shares. 40% went to the owner of the boat and net, the remainder to the crew. The skipper received 2 shares, along with certain other benefits from the owners. His second in command and menders of the net received 1.5 shares, and those who hauled the net 1 share each. So there was a way of sharing the profit with everybody who was working there. Let's go ahead and skip down to verse 23. Notice what Jesus did in Galilee when he started his ministry. It says, Jesus went about all Galilee, teaching in their synagogue. So he didn't just hang out in Capernaum, which had a synagogue, but all of Galilee. He went around all the towns, or a lot of the towns, and preached in synagogues, plural, many synagogues, healing all manner of sicknesses and so forth, all manner of disease among the people. Verse 24, it's interesting. It says here, his fame, and I mentioned, you know, that you would hear about John the Baptist or you'd hear about Jesus. His fame went throughout all Syria. Syria's way up here. This is another one of Herod's realms here. You got to go past that one to get up to the country of Syria, where Damascus was. His fame went that direction. And they brought him all sick people, who were taken with different diseases and torments, and those which were possessed with demons, those which were lunatic and had the palsy and so forth. And there followed him great multitudes of people from Galilee. Okay? That's where he's preaching. From Decapolis, over here, where there were Hellenized Jews and Gentiles. Doesn't say who. And from Jerusalem. And from Judea, down here. And from beyond Jordan, over here. This is the capital, so this would be the other beyond Jordan, Perea. People from all over were attracted to Jesus for whatever the reason. He had many disciples besides, you know, the ones closest to him. Maybe I say disciples. He had many that followed him and listened to him. Anyway, they weren't all disciples. That would be incorrect to say that. Then you got the Sermon on the Mount, chapters 5 to 7. Doesn't say where that, I don't think it says where that mountain is. Skip past that. Go to chapter 8. Notice chapter 8, verse 5. "And when Jesus was entered into Capernaum, there came unto him a centurion, beseeching him." Why was a centurion in Capernaum? Because there was a Roman garrison there. Centurion be under over 100 men. "And he healed the centurion's son." In verse 14, we read about Peter's mother-in-law. So Peter had a wife. And Peter's wife, Peter and/or his wife were from Capernaum, and his mother-in-law lived there in Capernaum. Peter was a local. Notice verse 18. "Now when Jesus saw great multitudes about him," now this is in the area of Capernaum, "he saw great multitudes about him, He gave commandment to depart to the other side. The other side. And that means get in a boat. Now, if you look at the Sea of Galilee here, there in Capernaum, other side. That's going this way. Over here. It's going this way. Now, that's interesting in and of itself. Because what's on the other side? The Decapolis. Gentiles. Gymnasia. Baths. All the stuff that the Jews wouldn't have anything to do with. And to the Jew, it was all idolatry and demonism, the whole thing. And Jesus told the disciples, get in the boat, we're going to the other side. When he said we're going to the other side, they knew what that meant. That meant they're going over here. That's a place they wouldn't go. But now they got this rabbi that they're following. And the rabbis have their ideas. And Jesus' ideas sometimes were off the charts. And it doesn't say too much about what they were saying here, but this had to be very odd for them. What are we doing going over here? We don't belong over there. What's he taking us over there for? I think that was going on, because we're going to see something here in just a minute that makes that seem likely. In fact, it was too far to walk. You couldn't walk. I mean, it's about 8 miles across, but by the time you do this walk, it would take you maybe a day or two to walk. So they just put in the boat and go across. In Mark chapter 4, in fact, they didn't just put in a boat. The disciples went, and perhaps some other people, we don't know. In Mark 4, verse 36, I think it is. And when they had sent away the multitude, they took him even as he was in the ship. And there were also with him other little ships. Now, these boats that they had on the Sea of Galilee were not huge boats. This is a 8 by 12 mile lake. They didn't have monstrous fishing boats. And that's why when these winds got up, these little boats, they were bouncing around. It scared them. They didn't have huge, these weren't ocean-going vessels. they were small. This wasn't an ocean. It was just a lake. Another thing about a lake, by the way, is especially one that's down in a hole, you don't have a whole lot of area for these waves to be dissipated. By the time they could be out to sea, if you're out in the Mediterranean, that you got a whole ocean for them to get to the waves to get lost. If you're in a small lake like this, they got bouncing off the sides. The wave energy bounce off the shores and get compounding. So that's why one of the reasons why it could be so bad so quick. Well, he said he's going to go to the other side. Now, as I said, a Jew wouldn't go there because it would be unclean. We read in Acts 10 where where you read it, they wouldn't have anything to do with a Gentile. Wouldn't want to touch, get near, eat with, whatever. Share a vessel with, drink out of the same cup with. But they're going across here to the area where it was a Gadarene area. Now, this town was actually off, about 6 miles offshore, but apparently must have controlled access to the lake. So it was still called the same region, even though the town itself was off the lake. Notice in verse 28. And when he was come to the other side, into the country of the Gergesenes, there met him two possessed with devils, coming out of the tombs, exceeding fierce, so that no one may pass that way. Met him. It just says met him. In Mark chapter 5, verse 2, it says, now I'm going to try, I can't prove something here, I just want to show you the possibility. And when he was come out of the ship, immediately there met him out of the tombs, a man with an unclean spirit. In Luke chapter 8, and verse 27, and when he went forth to land, there met him out of the city a certain man which had devils a long time, and so forth. It's not mentioned in John. Anybody notice something about those scriptures? Maybe. Yeah. It doesn't say anything about the disciples getting out of the boat. Maybe maybe this is just one of those occasions where they said, hey, you know, this, we might be your disciples, but, you know, some lines we're not going to cross. You know, I don't know what they said. But there's nothing here about them getting out of any of the boats. And the way it specifically says he did this in two of them, it sounds like he was on his own there. But he's making a point, isn't he? Because you know, in other places he said, you know, he told the disciples they're sent to the lost children of the house of Israel. He told the woman at the well that he wasn't sent to her. And, you know, he had some fairly harsh things to say to some Gentiles. But, you know, their faith sometimes was greater than those in Israel, as he pointed out. He made a point here, didn't he? He went to an area where Jews wouldn't go because of their rules, not God's rules, but their rules, a place where they wouldn't go. He got out of the boat and had contact. It doesn't say he touched him, but he probably did. But he had contact in some form with some demon-possessed people and cast the demons out. And a Jew wouldn't even go here. So he's at least showing them in their training, the disciples, he's showing them that God cares for all people, right? I mean, we know that there are scriptures that say that the Messiah was going to be, what does it say, a light to the Gentiles? Or no, to him the Gentiles will look. You know, Jesus' ministry was always about the Gentiles, too. It just came in time. Interesting point in verse 30. There was a herd of swine, really, you know, wild boars. I think in Mark it says it might be 1,000 or to a couple thousand. I don't remember what it says. I should look it up. Mark 5. It says great herd. Well, I thought it gave a number there. Oh, there it is. About 2,000. Verse 13. Yeah, 2,000. These are boars. According to some people who have analyzed this scripture, and I don't know how you know exactly what kind of pigs these were, but at least wild boars are good swimmers. So they shouldn't have necessarily drowned just because they went in the water. But of course, they're demon possessed, and it destroyed them just because the demons want to be destructive, I guess. I think it also indicates, of course, then they wanted Jesus to leave because there was a living being made with these boars, these swine, which indicates to me that it's a totally Gentile area. Obviously, you're not going to make a living raising pigs in a Jewish area. Chapter 9. It says, he entered a ship and passed over and came to his own city, came back home to Capernaum. So again, getting a ship, go across. Verse 9. This is where he runs into Matthew or Levi. He says he saw Matthew sitting at the receipt of custom. Now, you've got a port city and a major trade route. You're going to have tax collectors there, aren't you? If you're the Romans, that's a place to have your tax collectors. You've got a lot of people coming through. You charge them for whatever. You charge them for walking on the road. You charge them for importing this or that. You charge them for whatever. There's, you know, the Jews... Some Jews, like Matthew, were tax collectors. Now, in the United States, we've had historically this feeling about politicians or about used car salesmen or whatever. Well, a tax collector in Jewish society was way down the bottom. Not only were you cooperating with the occupying force, the Romans, but most of them were, well, all of them, made their living by collecting taxes. So what's that mean? The Romans paid you? No. It means they told you you needed to collect whatever, you know, whatever you're supposed to collect. And what your living was how much more you charged. And there's a fair rate for that. I don't know what it would be. What did most of them do? They charged more than the fair rate. And that's why they were so despised. They were cooperating with the occupying forces, and they were taking advantage of people by lining their own pockets and getting rich. By soaking people with the taxes they took. And they had the Roman army to back them up. You couldn't just say, no, I'm not paying. I mean, they had a Roman garrison there. So they were despised. People like Matthew were despised. And there were a lot of them. And it says later on that Jesus, when he'd have dinner at his place, it was all sinners, public, you know, tax collectors and sinners came over. So there were plenty of them there. But one of them he called to be a disciple. Notice verse 14. It says that then came to him the disciples of John saying, and they had a question about fasting. What does that mean? That means from down here where John had been preaching, he had disciples. And those disciples came up to Capernaum to talk to Jesus. Compare notes. Whatever. They were following, you wouldn't call him Rabbi John the Baptist. He was actually from a priestly family. He could have been a priest. Wasn't. But what's this tell you about the whole society? And this is what I was talking in the beginning. If you lived here, you could walk up here. And if you lived here, you could walk down here. They were occupied by the Romans, but they had freedom. Now, they didn't focus on the freedoms they had. But you could go where you wanted to. Paul traveled all over the world. Now, he was a Roman citizen. But he could have done that pretty much. He could have done a lot of that without being a Roman citizen. There was freedom. As long as you didn't cross certain lines or cross the king or whatever. It was somewhat free. Yeah, there were slaves. I'm not saying it was idealistic in our modern Western idea of freedom, but they had freedom of association. The Jews met in the synagogues. They meet by the river if they needed to. If they didn't have 10 people, whatever the rules were, they had freedom to travel where they wanted to travel. They had freedom to go up to Jerusalem to keep the pilgrimage feasts. They had a lot of freedom, and the Roman government really wasn't interested in making life horrible for them. They just wanted to keep the peace. I don't believe that whoever's in charge, Tiberius or whoever it was in Rome, really cared one whit about the Jews one way or the other. As long as they just not cause a problem and pay their taxes, everything's fine. They weren't really being abused, at least at this time they weren't. And when they got crushed later on, it's because they rebelled, not because they were just sitting around minding their own business. Notice verse 18 in chapter 9. We read about a ruler. In Matthew, it says a ruler. If you look in the other Gospels, we read that it's the ruler of the synagogue. The Ark of Synagogue, the one who was had the responsibilities in the synagogue. Notice chapter 10, verse 4. Jesus calls another disciple. He calls several. One of them here is called Simon the Canaanite. If you read Luke chapter 6, verse 15, he's called Simon the Zealot. Remember I told you there was this religious party or a party that was dedicated to the overthrow of the Roman government. They were called Zealots. Simon was a Zealot. Now, I guess he was an ex-zealot because Jesus wasn't into overthrowing the government. So Simon had to unlearn what he had learned before. But in a way, he was doing the same thing, wasn't he? He was part of a new government, part of a new system. But he had to learn it was a different system. It was based on service, not control. And he had to learn a lot. But he switched from one fringe ideology to another one. There are some who think that all of the disciples were Galileans, except perhaps Judas, who was apparently Judean. I don't know one way or the other. Just throw that out. And verse 6 is where you read that they were sent to the house of Israel. But Jesus had made a point. He interacted with the centurion, the Roman centurion. He had gone to, he'd healed the Gadarene demoniac. He had talked, not here, we read about it in John, the woman at the well in Samaria. He dealt with different people that were not Jewish. So he was setting the stage for the future in that regard. In chapter 11, verse 2, John had been in prison. Because of the Herods, we talked about that. Verse 20 in chapter 11. Jesus talks about some of the cities. Just mention these cities. Chorazin. Chorazin is up north of Capernaum a little bit. Not very far away. Not very far. And it says Bethsaida. Bethsaida. That's a word that just means the house of fishermen, you know, fishing village. And that's what it was. In fact, it probably, along with Gennesaret, probably kind of like suburbs. If you went to Capernaum or you went there, it wouldn't be that much different. They're all kind of huddled up there close together on the shore. It mentions Chorazin, Bethsaida, Capernaum, which are exalted unto heaven. You know, it was a powerful, rich city. Not powerful in that it had its own government and own power that way, but they were economically a powerful city and proud of themselves. Verse 21. Oh, no, I want to skip down to chapter 13. I might want to mention one thing in chapter 12. Oh, here we go. This quoting from the Old Testament. In his name shall the Gentiles trust. Chapter 12, verse 21. Jesus' ministry was always about the Gentiles as well. All right, chapter 13. Notice in chapter 13, now we read through, I think it was last week, Jesus went out of the house and sat by the seaside. Great multitudes came together, verse 2, to him. So he went out into a ship and sat. And the whole multitude sat on the shore, or stood on the shore. So, again, you've got this big lake that's down in a hole, 690 feet below sea level. So, in any direction, leaving Galilee, except for south. Now, obviously, right here, it has to be low because the river's going that way. But every other direction, it's up. And up significantly from the shore of the Sea of Galilee. So, you've got a natural amphitheater in a lot of cases, don't you? If you go on a boat and sit out on the water and you talk, if you ever talked on the water, you know that really carries a long way. It bounces off the water, your voice. And then it gets to the shore and it's going up. You've got an amphitheater effect. And Jesus used that on several occasions to talk to people without being in the middle of a crowd. In verse 54, toward the end here of the chapter. Now it says that when he had come to his own country, he taught them in their synagogue. Now here, it's talking about his own country, that he actually, in traveling around Galilee, he came back to Nazareth. And he had no respect there. Ah, we know him. We know his dad. We know his mom. We know his brothers. Who's he? And he didn't perform any mighty works. They didn't have faith and they didn't respect him. Prophets without honor in his own country. But that's in Nazareth. Now, chapter 14, which we read today. Just a few comments which I think are interesting. We already went over the thing about the Herods. And the Herods were a mess. And we know what happened there, so I don't need to go over that now. In verse 13, Jesus heard of John's death. He heard of it and he departed by ship into a desert place apart. And then the people followed him out of foot, out of the city. So he didn't go across. You know, he just left by ship and went, you know, somewhere along the shore. And he got a head start on everybody, but again, it's only 7 miles wide, 12 miles long, or 8 miles wide, 12 miles long. You can see across. When he went and sailed, he's going down there. Okay, we'll go. You know, we'll go on foot and catch up with him when he puts ashore again. But you notice Jesus was apparently emotionally somewhat upset about his second cousin's death. And, of course, the whole circumstances of it happening the way it did, you know, is bad too. And it also, I would imagine, made it very real to him that his time wasn't that far off either. So he wanted to get away for a while. But the crowds, of course, kept caught up with him as they always did. People walked, he sailed. Now, verse 15. Now, we read, and I didn't want to comment because I wanted to bring it out in the sermon. And again, I can't prove anything here, but there's something interesting. All these people had followed, and they're out there, right? And it says, when it was evening, his disciples came to him, saying, this is a desert place. Send the multitude away, that they may go to the villages and buy themselves something to eat. why didn't they just say so they can go home? Now, I never thought of this before. You know, why did they have to go to the villages and buy something to eat? Why didn't they just go home and get something to eat? There's two possibilities I can think of. Maybe you can think of another one. One is, we already read that these people were coming from all over the place. So we had disciples that were, you know, from different parts of the whole region. However, if they were disciples from different parts of the whole region, they, by the time they came up to Galilee, they must have had places to stay, you know, because they'd been there for a while. So I can't imagine that they were all, you know, just living in hotels all the time or whatever. I don't think that's the case. But what's another possibility? Why could there have been a lot of people in town listening to Jesus that were not from town? Anything pop into mind? Yeah. Could have been on their way to one of the feasts. We don't know. But that could be. You know, sometimes the crowds could have been, you know, if you lived up here and you're on your way to Jerusalem and you're passing through Galilee, you're going to check this guy out because word's been getting out. He's healing people. He's casting out demons. There's miracles. Let's check him out. Side trip. The way to the feast. You know, whatever. You're gonna listen to what he has to say. So that's a possibility. Just throwing it out there. The reality is, regardless of whether it's true here or not, that's part of the culture of the time. Is that three times a year, and especially in the spring and in the fall, with a larger portion of your family, you're going to go up to Jerusalem. And it's a big party. You're taking your crops, maybe some cows, maybe it's a long way, just money, you've already, you know, slaughtered the cows or whatever. And you're gonna feast, have a good time for a whole week, or longer than a week. And on your way, you know what it's like when you go to the feast or when you go on vacation? Isn't it nice when you go like to the ocean, if you ever go to the ocean? Everybody's on vacation, everybody's in a good mood. You know, you don't take your problems with you on vacation normally. At least before cell phones, we didn't. So, if you're on your way up to Jerusalem, and everybody else is on the way up to Jerusalem, everybody's happy. You're finished with the harvest. You're ready to eat some better food than you can have all the rest of the year. Everybody's in a good mood. The kids are happy. If you're taking your kids along, it's a wonderful time. And that's part of the reality of Jewish life at the time, was three times a year you had this going on. Verse 24, we talked about that. The winds were contrary. I mean, you could get these quick winds whip up. Let me just read very quickly page 98 in this Exploring Bible Times book. I don't think I read this yet. The calmness of the Sea of Galilee depends on certain weather conditions. The lake itself sits at the bottom of a geological bowl with elevated mountains and plateaus surrounding all but the southern end of the sea. Thus, as warm air arises from the water's surface, cool air comes from the higher elevations and can cause quick changes in the lake's stability. Any of you live near a mountain like we do, you get that. You get these currents around, you know, around dusk where the cold air goes down. That's why you don't see orchards where I live down at the bottom of the valleys, because the cold air comes down the mountain for some reason, because it's heavier. It comes down and settles in the valleys. And that's why you would get frost there early or late in the season, so you don't plant trees, you don't plant orchards at the bottom. So that's the same thing at the Sea of Galilee. You get this cold air going down. It's particularly true when the western winds come in from the Mediterranean in the early afternoons during the summer. Since it doesn't rain in the country from mid-May to mid-September, no moisture is related to this increased wave activity. However, in the winter months, these western winds are responsible for bringing storms with high winds and rain into the area. Another type of storm that rises on the lake is called a sharkia. The name is derived from the Arabic word shark, which means east. It occurs in the winter months during the early evening hours when atmospheric conditions allow for eastern winds to come in from the Transjordan. So you got winds coming in this way. More than once, fishermen on the Sea of Galilee have been out on a peaceful lake only to have waves suddenly erupt when the sharkia begins. So, that's all that I wanted to cover today. We have half of the book of Matthew yet to go, and the scene will change from Galilee, where the ministry is now,
to Judea, around Jerusalem.
And I'll plan in a future sermon to go down there and share some more information that I've learned in the meantime. And I hope this overview has helped you to place the early ministry of Jesus in its historical and cultural context, and that Jesus' words and deeds can be that much more real for you today.